This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor with Germanicus, Mark of Lejos. I am Gaius, John Batchelor. We're in Londinium, 91 AD. Very safe, thank you very much. This is the first century of two magnificent, powerful, might of Rome centuries we will enjoy. The third century gets bumpy. We make some adjustments in the fourth century, and we're off to Constantinople for another 1,000 years. However, we're looking at the fog of war in the 21st century. And since the beginning of the conflict in Ukraine, Vladimir Putin and other voices in the Kremlin have mentioned the nuclear weapons that Russia possesses. It's called rattling the nuclear saber, is the metaphor. Well, we look now at the nuclear saber the first time it was rattled, and that's 1945. The decision to drop the bomb, the decision where to drop the bomb, the decision when, all of those things had to be put together by the leadership in Washington. Henry Stimson, 77 years old, the Secretary of War had served, Mr. Hoover, Secretary of State, had served TR. So he was a longtime Republican artifact at the cabinet level. General Groves commanded the gadget, the putting together of the bomb. Oppenheimer commanded the scientists to put together the bomb, but they didn't know it would work. They have to meet as if it will work. They're meeting the targeting committee in April and May of 1945 as the bomb still hasn't been tested. The targeting committee comes up with three cities, Kyoto, Hiroshima, and Niigata. When Henry Stimson learns that Kyoto is number one on the list for General Groves, he says, reject. You will not bomb Kyoto. So they get into an argument. It spills out from May into June, and the interim committee then meets in the White House in June to decide where we will drop the bomb. However, the important question for them is not where we will drop the bomb, but what do we want the bomb to do? We're told one bomb, one city. What is the purpose of this? The argument came down to Marshall wanted a military target to say we're not trying to kill civilians, we're trying to end the war now by destroying Japan's ability to wage war. Well, that had already happened. Good heavens, the Japanese fleet was on the bottom of the Pacific. The Air Force was paper, and the army was dug in a series of islands, starving to death. The population was starving to death. There were no resources. Eventually, Curtis LeMay's 21st Air Force would burn 60 cities, burn out the center. All of that was going on as they're deciding in Washington, why are we dropping the bomb? And the reason, Germanicus, I have this from a new book, Road to Surrender, Three Men and the Countdown to the End of World War II by Evan Thomas, the distinguished essayist. The reason they wanted to drop the bomb was to intimidate the Japanese leadership to surrender. I tell all that because right now I'm going to entertain the idea that the Kremlin has a committee to decide when and how and why to use a nuclear weapon in the event that Crimea falls or in the event those cruise missiles range into Rostov-on-Don or Moscow. Those cruise missiles can reach Moscow. In that event, Moscow must be prepared. Your measure of using the weapon in 2023, is it so profoundly different than it was in 1945?
There's a cultural disconnect here in the sense that in 1945, the U.S. had been at war in a sort of holy war, in fact, good versus evil, a divinely ordained conflict, an existential conflict. In fact, on his very own, the president, FDR, had announced unconditional surrender as the only acceptable objective in the war. And thus, by mid-1945, Americans in general, but especially leaders, were not fettered in any way by the killing of civilians. In fact, hundreds of thousands of Germans had been killed in the strategic bombing. And equally, as you pointed out, Curtis LeMay had effectively executed an incendiary-based strategic bombing of Japan that had already killed at least 500,000 people. So this was not a difficult solution. Furthermore, and I have to emphasize this, the U.S. had just fought two battles at Iwo Jima and Okinawa, and the total casualties that the U.S. sustained taking these islands were greater in sum than the Japanese. Of course, most of them were wounded, but it was very difficult to for Americans to distinguish between the badly wounded and the dead in terms of losses. They were all terrible losses. And so the U.S. took 100,000 casualties taking those islands, and military leaders could only imagine what would await them were they to proceed to Operations Olympic and Coronet, which would be the September-November landings on the Japanese home islands. And the fact is, the U.S. did not even know how much stuff the Japanese had assembled and how many divisions they had. And it would have been a terrible moment. And in many ways, up until his death, FDR was mortified at the idea of the U.S. getting embroiled in a repeat of the Western Front in ways that the U.S. had avoided, obviously, in World War I. But now to invade Japan and suffer 1 or 2 million dead, and of course, Japan would be totally destroyed as a nation. Tens of millions of Japanese would die. In fact, even in mid-41, the mining of Japanese waters and the submarine blockade meant that Japan was in a position with most of its urban population out in the countryside where Japanese peasants were withholding food from them. It was a situation that would have led to, had the war continued, a depopulation of Japan. It would have been terrible because the U.S. would have tens of millions of Japanese dead on their conscience.
And Washington knew this. Washington knew that a siege would bring Japan to its knees. It didn't believe, however, it would force the leadership to surrender. The word surrender was banned in Tokyo. So the bomb was to scare them. That's why I'm using it as an example. You could see argument being made at the Kremlin when they're about to lose Crimea. We've got to scare them to the negotiating table.
Well, let's make a contrast here that I think is important. And in 1945, scaring them seemed like the more modest and reasonable and even rational choice rather than pursuing the terrible course that lay before them. And in contrast, since the use of those weapons by the United States, there has been a glacial shift in the attitude of all of humanity on nuclear use. It has become a huge taboo, and the taboo grows and grows and grows. And it is loath for any nation to use a nuclear weapon where they will be tarred forever as the consummate evil of evils. So I think there is a tremendous aversion to nuclear use by everyone who possesses nuclear weapons today. Much in contrast to 1945.
Do you hear the Kremlin aversion? Because it repeatedly talking about their weapons, not only their nuclear weapons, but their launch systems. Satan too.
The use of a carefully targeted rhetoric by Russia about the circumstances under which they might or might not use nuclear weapons is, from their perspective, essential to try and ward off Western escalation. And U.S.-NATO escalation is proof that that strategy has been appropriate. Because if Russia were to concede the entire nuclear possibility, then they would leave themselves open to direct NATO attack. That's how they see it. Now, when would they actually decide that the time had come to use those weapons, an all or nothing moment that is truly exist or not exist, do or die? I don't know what would bring them to that point. I would imagine that were NATO to very recklessly launch cruise missile strikes on Russia and inundate the Crimea, as it were, with targeted strikes on Sevastopol, destroying the Kerch Bridge, breaking the water supply to Crimea from the mainland, all that sort of stuff would bring a Russian response. But I would imagine that response would not be nuclear, but rather actual strikes on the places from whence those attacks by NATO had been launched, meaning NATO air bases. In all probability,
that's General Marshall. You're talking about General Marshall. Yeah. That's at a naval base.
But, yeah. Well, I'm thinking that's what the Russians would do
first. And that's what they thought of in 1945, except for it was overridden by the interim committee by saying that won't scare them.
Right. But I don't think the Russians believe that a nuclear weapon will scare the U.S. I think they believe that it will lead to an immediate nuclear escalation.
All right, if it leads to a nuclear escalation, that was not going to happen in 45. Nobody else had the weapon. I agree that the analogy breaks down at this point. I do agree. I just wanted to entertain it because they've been talking nuke, so I wanted to take it seriously. And my contribution was the first time they talked about nukes, they had this argument in 1945. Why are we doing this?
They had an embarrassment of choices, and the Russia initiating a nuclear weapon is not an embarrassment of choices. It's total, absolute hysterical desperation. Russians aren't there yet, and an escalation in the so-called conventional realm, that is to say, responding to a NATO attack on Russia by striking NATO bases, that would be escalation enough, because the next step would be to nuclear conflict. And there's no reason to jump two steps ahead or two rungs up on the ladder to nuclear escalation. The world would be in an instant condition of hysteria were NATO and Russia to go to war. And I think that would be enough to scare NATO.
It is Russia's opinion that they're at war with NATO now, correct, Germanicus?
Yes, but that those, again, are employed or deployed rhetorically as ways of improving Russia's standing and consideration on the part of the third world, China, India, the BRICS. And they're not a statement of belligerence. The German foreign minister made the same statement that NATO was at war with Russia. That didn't mean that NATO was actually in a state of direct belligerence. And so what an attack on a NATO basis in response to an attack by NATO on Russia would mean would be that, in fact, belligerence will attain. And this would be a tremendous shock. And even those who in the U.S. never follow world affairs would suddenly realize that we were on the edge of potential extinction. So I think this would be the path that escalation would travel. And of course, the U.S. and NATO would have to be the initiators of this escalation. Russia is not motivated at this point and probably will never be motivated to escalate to a point where they could be defeated and destroyed. And instead, they're very carefully and within somewhat strict limits pursuing a strategy that will bring Ukraine to its knees and thus allow them to conclude the war with their objectives attained. They have no incentive to escalate.
All right, we'll leave it there. We'll leave it there. The three red lines: Crimea is threatened, F-16s deployed, cruise missiles deployed. Three red lines. Your move, Russia. Germanicus and I are going to the theater. Now, there's still the concern about the epidemic. And we in the Roman Empire do not have the medicine that you in the 21st century have. Therefore, our simple way of dealing with an affliction that we're not sure of is to close the roads and to close the seaports and to accept no one to come overland to us and to concern ourselves with our neighbors. So we're going to the theater tonight to see if there is a performance. It's unlikely. We're going to be very careful. And we will return to debate Russia another day. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. Oh, we sacrificed the god Augustus, of course. Excuse me. Got to get that in. Friends of History Debating Society with Michael Vlahos, Germanicus, and I'm Gaius, John Batchelor.